evidence he always took his mark. He's the all-American bullet-headed Saxon mother's son.
All your children sing.
Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill.
Jungle where the mighty tiger lies. Bill and his elephants were taken by surprise.
So Captain Marvel zapped him right between the eyes.
All the children sing.
Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill.
The children asked him if to kill was not a sin.
That when he looked so fierce,
his mommy petted him.
If looks could kill, it would have been us instead of him.
All the children sing.
Hey, Bungalow Bill, what did you kill? Bungalow Bill.
Returning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this program, we're listening to Tom Friedman talk about a carbon tax with Tom Ashbrook.
Tom Friedman. A couple of calls here. Tommy in Nashville, Tennessee. Tommy, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It sounds to me like it's just a gimmick to get more taxes. I mean, fuel's as high now as it's ever been, and, you know, there's come a time you got to quit taxing and start watching what you spend. They're going to have to be accountable. We can't just keep paying more and more taxes all the time.
And what if we don't have enough to pay for what we already owe, Tommy? What do we do?
We do without. That's what I do when I can't afford something. We got to start doing the same thing. The American people are doing without right now. And I'm a truck driver. I work every day. But if I ain't got money, I don't buy it. That's just what an American needs to start doing the same thing. Our government needs to start doing the same thing.
Tommy, we got it. Tom Friedman, Tommy takes his truck to the gas pump. He sees what it costs. It's high already. More doesn't sound good to him.
Well, first of all, you know, carbon tax could easily be phased in, you know, 5-10 cents a gallon over several years. You know, Tom, I live out in Bethesda, Maryland. I drive in to work every day. You know what I notice when I drive in? The variation in gas prices of 5 or 10 cents just from one gas station to the next. And so I believe that, you know, this could be phased in ways that would not actually be that noticeable to people, number one. And number two, you know, I had the pleasure of chatting with Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, a few weeks ago. And we were talking about just phase-in things, you know, and he pointed out to me something, and he was not endorsing anything, so don't get me wrong here, but we were just talking about how to phase things in. He said, you know, back in the 80s, there was the Greenspan Commission on Social Security Reform. Do you realize some of the reforms that the Greenspan Commission on Social Security Reform decided on then are still being phased in today?
Well, your point is this would come in slowly. So
you could come in slowly.
You're not going to make $1 trillion if you bring in a decade if you come in slowly.
You know, again, it depends how slowly, up front, up back, whatever. And by the way, $1 trillion would be my goal. I'd settle for half, okay? You know, I'm also a realist. And to Tommy's point also, you know, and I know where he's coming from, and it's, I think, a sincere sentiment. But, you know, it reminds me of a story Bob Inglis told me. Bob was a congressman from South Carolina who was defeated in the by a Tea Party insurgent 2 years ago in the midterm election. And he is famous for speaking at a town hall meeting in a small South Carolina town. And a constituent stood up, wagged his finger at him, and said, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare." You know, a lot of people think Medicare is some entitlement that comes from, I don't know, Mars or from the ground or the heavens. You know, keep your government hands off my Medicare. So all I'm trying to say is, I think we have to make choices here. You see, if you can grow without a plan, Tom, but you better not cut without a plan. You cut without a plan, you can hit bones, arteries, you know, you can really do damage. When I look at the sequester, that to me is cutting without a plan. And all I'm trying to say is, I think we need a grand bargain. I think it would be a huge lift for the country. I think we need to invest, cut, and tax as Tommy says. But I think we need to do all three. And somehow we got to do it in the least painful, most intelligent way possible. So I've thrown out a carbon tax idea. If somebody's got a better idea, please let me know. But what we're doing if we don't do that, Tom, is we're in effect taunting the two most powerful forces on the planet, mm-hmm. the market and Mother Nature at the same time. We're basically saying to both of them, what you got, babe? What you got? Mother Nature, all you got is one little centigrade, right? That's all you've got? Oh, I'm not afraid. What do you got, Mr. Market? No interest rate rise or interest rates. We could wake up one day, Tom, and discover what they got, you know. And that's what I'm trying to forestall.
And be flat on our back. Joe, in Iowa City, Iowa, you're on the air with Tom Friedman.
Hey, Mr. Friedman, I think you're right on with this carbon tax. What you're proposing is just what the country needs, and basically it's just to pay for the externality that's created by burning carbon-based fuels. So all you're proposing and what we all need to do is just clean up after ourselves. And if we make garbage, then we should be responsible for the cost of removing that garbage from the system. And you're absolutely right on with all the jobs that it can create. And so it doesn't seem like anybody's made a really great story for why the carbon tax is so critically important. And Tommy, the caller before, the truck driver, yeah, I agree. People don't want to pay more, but we have to look at the reality of competing long term as well. And the solution for the country and the economy trying to just go with cheap energy, cheap energy, cheap energy is going to really hurt us eventually in the long run, because as the other world economies deal with this, they're going to be in a more competitive situation. I mean, I remember when the catalytic converters, everyone was crying about that too. And what our auto companies were in a position when all they had were pickup trucks and big SUVs, and then when gas spiked, whatever, 6-8 years ago,
they were in a non-competitive
position.
Joe, we've got it. I appreciate your call. There's a shout out to you, Tom. Let's get another here. Liz in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Liz, you're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to ask Tom Friedman mm-hmm. how he thinks Congress will pass this wonderful carbon tax legislation now that Citizens United allows unlimited amounts of corporate money to flow into American elections at the local, state, and national levels.
Well, Liz, your presumption there that would push hammer and tongs against this legislation.
You can't get legislation. I believe you can't get any environmental legislation passed if Congress is controlled by corporate money.
Tom Friedman?
Liz raises a very important point. I'd say, just to lift her spirits a little bit, two things. One, California has managed to pass some amazing carbon and climate legislation and clean energy legislation despite massive gobs of money from fossil fuel industries, because it turned out they've also got a rising green industry there that was able to fight back, and a lot of concerned citizens, number one. You raise a very legitimate point, but I'm a big believer in the bully pulpit of the presidency, not the magic of it, but if we start simply having a different conversation in this country, you have no idea what you'll catalyze. Look how many young people came out to elect President Obama for the first time, and think about the money that was arrayed against him in that election. So, nothing ventured, nothing gained. If we shrink all our aspirations to fit what we think is the sort of we can't do anything more in this country, then we'll shrink ourselves.
Let's go to Bill in Watertown, Connecticut. Bill, you're on with Tom Friedman.
Hi, I just wanted to make a point. I think it would be foolish to think that the Chinese would gladly comply. It seems as though they've been making huge investments over the last 30 years into oil and all other energy sources, precious metals and so forth. And for them to just gladly lay down, we'd have to put a lot more thought into that.
You don't think they would follow this path? They wouldn't go with measures to cut back on fossil fuel consumption there, I guess is your point, Bill. Is that right?
No, my point is this. Like I said, they've been investing in oil. They're in Africa big time.
So what?
Where President Obama wouldn't allow us to drill off of Florida, they've come in with the Cubans and they plan on like a cooperative effort to take the oil from outside the Florida basin and use it there.
Bill, I think we got it. Let us go with that. Tom Friedman, okay, we could do this, but the Chinese aren't going to go there, asserts Bill. So what?
Well, two things, Bill. One is I'd urge you to Google China and carbon tax, number one. Two, I'd urge you to Google China and auto mileage standards. And see the kind of auto mileage standards the Chinese have been imposing on their own car industry. And three, I'd urge you to Google pictures of weather today in Beijing, because in the last month, the pollution in Beijing has been so bad. There have been so many sick people as a result. Chinese simply cannot breathe. And I don't believe that this model of... by the way, the Chinese are doing a lot of everything because of the energy they need. So yes, they're doing a lot of oil, they're doing a lot of carbon, they're doing a lot of nuclear, and they're doing a huge amount of green. The reason if you go out to buy a solar panel today, the price is so low is because the Chinese have been making so many for themselves and they're doing to solar panels what they did to tennis shoes. So I think when we lead, others follow. China is not going to be able to sustain the kind of path they're on right now. Now, when every Chinese can afford a car, they will simply choke to death.
Tom, go big again here. I mean, I don't know if this is the right way or not, but I definitely resonate with your assertion here that we've got to be able to think big and act big or we're dead on arrival. If we think every big idea is dead on arrival, so are we, you right. And just getting out of that box, that kind of triage box, last minute, you know, just some slapdash temporary solution to everything, one way or another, we've got to get out of it. But I think a lot of people have lost confidence that even if you hand this money over to the government, they're going to do something so positive with it. There's a lot of skepticism always going to be poured into some unfunded pension tank, or it's going to, you know, it's just going to disappear down some, what Jesse Helms used to say, rat hole. How do you get past that to get out into, you know, that kind of American dynamic of, hey, we're doing big things, they're working, this is great, let's go.
Well, you know, it's a huge point. It's what we wrote about in the last book. And let me just step back for a second and say this. You know, one of the things that's always troubled me about the Obama presidency is that it's got no narrative. I don't know what it's about. You know, it's a collection of different initiatives. And I thought you saw it in his inaugural address and in his first State of the Union. It's just a lot of little things taken together. That's not to discount health care. I think that was a hugely important thing. I'd love to see him do the same in the energy field. So what should the vision of America be today? Well, I mean, to me, the organizing vision should be this. I would like to see America today be to the world what Cape Canaveral was to America back in the 1960s. What was it? Cape Canaveral was the place, the later Kennedy Space Center, where we launched our one moonshot. That was our big national project. We're not going to have one big national project anymore. What I want America to be, to be the platform where everyone in the world wants to come and launch their moonshot, where every American and everybody else out there wants to come to start something, some business, some NGO, some idea, some group, some organization, and they want to come here because we have the best education, the best infrastructure, the best patent rules, the best rule of law, the most government-funded research, the cleanest environment. And if we can make America that platform where everyone wants to launch something, okay, I promise you there will be jobs out there for everybody, you know, across the educational spectrum. That's to me, the organizing principle, and how we get that launching pad seems to be, to me, what our politics should be about today.
The urgency,
not balancing the budget.
Well,
you know?
I mean, that's a piece of it, but the urgency in your voice is we don't have forever to do that.
We don't have forever because Mother Nature and you know, Mother Nature is just sitting out there, and we can talk whatever we want. Tom, the president can say whatever he wants, but Mother Nature, as my teacher Tom Rob Watson always likes to say, she's just chemistry, biology, and physics. That's all she is. You can't tweet talk her. You can't talk her up. You can't talk her down. Can't say Mother Nature having a recession. Could you take a year off? Mother Nature always bats last, and she always bats 1,000. Do not mess with Mother Nature.
Not to mention the markets in their turn, and as you have written, the events of this last week show if we want to keep that beacon of, what, pluralism up there, you've got to keep the light tower strong.
You better believe it.
Tom Friedman, it's interesting online. A lot of pushback, but people thinking about America's big circumstances, and we are glad that you are too. Thank you so much for joining us today.
pleasure, Tom, as always.
New York Times' Tom Friedman is From Beirut to Jerusalem is out in extended edition.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I was born long ago in 1894. I've seen many a panic I will own. I've been hungry, I've been cold, and now I'm growing old. But the worst I've seen was 1931. Oh, those beans, bacon, and gravy, they almost drive me crazy. I eat them till I see them in my dreams. When I wake up each morning and another day is dawning, I know I'll have another mess of beans. Well, we congregate each morning in the county barn at dawning, and everyone is happy, so it seems. But when our work is done, we file in one by one and thank the Lord for one more mess of beans. Oh, those beans, bacon, and gravy, they almost drive me crazy. I eat them till I see them in my dreams. When I wake up each morning and another day is dawning, I know I'll get another mess of beans. We have hooverized on butter. For milk, we've only water, and I haven't seen a steak in many a day. For pies and cakes and jellies, we substitute sow bellies, for which we work the county road each day. Oh, those beans, bacon, and gravy, they almost drive me crazy. I eat them till I see them in my dreams. When I wake up in the morning and another day is dawning, then I know I'll get another mess of beans. If there ever comes a time when I have more than a dime, they'll have to put me under lock and key. For I've been broke so long, I can only sing the song of the workers and their misery. Oh, those beans, bacon, and gravy, they almost drive me crazy. I eat them till I see them in my dreams. When I wake up in the morning and another day is dawning, I know I'll get another mess of beans. Yes, those beans, bacon, and gravy, they almost drive me crazy. I eat them till I see them in my dreams. When I wake up in the morning and another day is dawning, well, I know I'll get another mess of beans.
During his second term as president, Ronald Reagan tells Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down the Berlin Wall. The president is speaking at the Brandenburg Gate.
Chancellor Kohl, Governing Mayor Dipkin, ladies and gentlemen, 24 years ago, President John F. Kennedy visited Berlin. And speaking to the people of this city and the world at the City Hall, well, since then, two other presidents have come, each in his turn, to Berlin. And today, I myself make my second visit to your city. We come to Berlin, we American presidents, because it's our duty to speak in this place of freedom. But I must confess, we're drawn here by other things as well, by the feeling of history in this city, more than 500 years older than our own nation, by the beauty of the Grunewald and the Tiergarten, most of all, by your courage and determination. Perhaps the composer Paul Lincke understood something about American presidents. You see, like so many presidents before me, I come here today because wherever I go, whatever I do, ich hab noch keinen Koffer in Berlin. Our gathering today is being broadcast throughout Western Europe and North America. I understand that it is being seen and heard as well in the East. To those listening throughout Eastern Europe, I extend my warmest greetings and the goodwill of the American people. To those listening in East Berlin, a special word. Although I cannot be with you, I address my remarks to you just as surely as to those standing here before me. For I join you, as I join your fellow countrymen in the West, in this firm, this unalterable belief, es gibt nur ein Berlin. Behind me stands a wall that encircles the free sectors of this city, part of a vast system of barriers that divides the entire continent of Europe. From the Baltic South, those barriers cut across Germany in a gash of barbed wire, concrete, dog runs, and guard towers. Farther south, there may be no visible, no obvious wall, but there remain armed guards and checkpoints all the same. still a restriction on the right to travel, still an instrument to impose upon ordinary men and women the will of a totalitarian state. Yet it is here in Berlin where the wall emerges most clearly. Here, cutting across your city, where the news photo and the television screen have imprinted this brutal division of a continent upon the mind of the world. Standing before the Brandenburg Gate, every man is a German, separated from his fellow men. Every man is a Berliner, forced to look upon a scar. President von Weizsäcker has said the German question is open as long as the Brandenburg Gate is closed. But today I say, as long as this gate is closed, as long as this scar of a wall is permitted to stand, it is not the German question alone that remains open, but the question of freedom for all mankind. Yet, I do not come here to lament, for I find in Berlin a message of hope, even in the shadow of this wall, a message of triumph. In this season of spring in 1945, the people of Berlin emerged from their air raid shelters to find devastation. Thousands of miles away, the people of the United States reached out to help. And in 1947, Secretary of State, as you've been told, George Marshall, announced the creation of what would become known as the Marshall Plan. Speaking precisely 40 years ago this month, he said, "Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos." In the Reichstag, a few moments ago, I saw a display commemorating this 40th anniversary of the Marshall Plan. I was struck by the sign on a burnt-out, gutted structure that was being rebuilt. I understand that Berliners of my own generation can remember seeing signs like it dotted throughout the western sectors of the city. The sign read simply, "The Marshall Plan is helping here to strengthen the free world." A strong free world in the West, that dream became real. Japan rose from ruin to become an economic giant. Italy, France, Belgium, virtually every nation in Western Europe saw political and economic rebirth. The European Community was founded. In West Germany and here in Berlin, there took place an economic miracle. The Wirtschaftswende. Adenauer, Erhard, Reuter, and other leaders understood the practical importance of liberty, that just as truth can flourish only when the journalist is given freedom of speech, so prosperity can come about only when the farmer and businessman enjoy economic freedom. The German leaders reduced tariffs, expanded free trade, lowered taxes. From 1950 to 1960 alone, the standard of living in West Germany and Berlin doubled. Where four decades ago there was rubble, today in West Berlin there is the greatest industrial output of any city in Germany. Busy office blocks, fine homes and apartments, proud avenues and the spreading lawns of parkland. Where a city's culture seemed to have been destroyed, today there are two great universities, orchestras and an opera, countless theaters and museums. Where there was want, today there's abundance. Food, clothing, automobiles, the wonderful goods of the Kudamm. From devastation, from utter ruin, you Berliners have in freedom rebuilt a city that once again ranks as one of the greatest on earth. And the Soviets may have had other plans, but my friends, there were a few things the Soviets didn't count on. Berliner Herz, Berliner Humor, ja und Berliner Schnauze. In the 1950s, Khrushchev predicted, "We will bury you." But in the West today, we see a free world that has achieved a level of prosperity and well-being unprecedented in all human history. In the communist world, we see failure, technological backwardness, declining standards of health. Now the Soviets themselves may, in a limited way, be coming to understand the importance of freedom. We hear much from Moscow about a new policy of reform and openness. Some political prisoners have been released. Certain foreign news broadcasts are no longer being jammed. Some economic enterprises have been permitted to operate with greater freedom from state control. Are these the beginnings of profound changes in the Soviet state, or are they token gestures intended to raise false hopes in the West or to strengthen the Soviet system without changing it? We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
And now for something completely different.